Hello, and welcome to another episode of the spellbinding adventure that is Exiting the Cave Short Reads. In today's episode, Lady Philosophy lays out for us the first of four arguments attempting to defang the problem of evil, and in the process, we discover that evil people simply don't exist. I know you're all sitting on pins and needles to find out what happens next, so I'll get out of the way here and let the action begin. Then I said, "Verily wondrous great are thy promises. Yet I do not doubt, but thou canst make them good. Only keep me not in suspense after raising such hopes." "Learn then first," said she, "how that power ever waits upon the good, while the bad are left wholly destitute of strength. Of these truths the one proves the other. For since good and evil are contraries, if it is made plain that good is power, the feebleness of evil is clearly seen, and, conversely, if the frail nature of evil is made manifest, the strength of good is thereby known. However, to win ampler credence for my conclusion, I will pursue both paths and draw confirmation for my statements first in one way and then in another. The carrying out of any human action depends upon two things, to wit, will and power. If either be wanting, nothing can be accomplished. For if the will be lacking, no attempt at all is made to do what is not willed. Whereas, if there be no power, the will is all in vain. And so, if thou seest any man wishing to attain some end, yet utterly failing to attain it, thou canst not doubt that he lacked the power of getting what he wished for.
Why, certainly not. There is no denying it.
Canst thou then doubt that he whom thou seest to have accomplished what he willed had also the power to accomplish it?
Of course not.
Then, in respect of what he can accomplish, a man is reckoned to be strong. In respect of what he cannot accomplish, weak?
Granted, said I.
Then dost thou remember that by our former reasonings, it was concluded that the whole aim of man's will, though the means of pursuit vary, is set intently upon happiness?
I do remember that this, too, was proved.
Dost thou also call to mind how happiness is absolute good, and therefore that when happiness is sought, it is good which is in all cases the object of desire?
Nay, I do not so much call to mind as keep it fixed in my memory.
Then all men, good and bad alike, with one indistinguishable purpose, strive to reach good?
Yes, that follows.
But it is certain that by attainment of good, men become good?
It is.
Then, do the good attain their object?
It seems so.
But if the bad were to attain the good which is their object, they could not be bad?
No.
Then, since both seek good, but while the one sort attain it, the other attain it not. Is there any doubt that the good are endued with power, while they who are bad are weak?
If any doubt it, he is incapable of reflecting on the nature of things, or the consequences involved in reasoning.
Again, supposing there are two things to which the same function is prescribed in the course of nature, and one of these successfully accomplishes the function by natural action, the other is altogether incapable of that natural action, instead of which, in a way other than is agreeable to its nature, it, I will not say fulfills its function, but feigns to fulfill it, which of these two would in thy view be the stronger?
I guess thy meaning, but I pray thee, let me hear thee more at large.
Walking is man's natural motion, is it not?
Certainly. Thou dost not doubt, I suppose, that it is natural for the feet to discharge this function?
No, surely I do not.
Now, if one man who is able to use his feet walks, and another to whom the natural use of his feet is wanting tries to walk on his hands, which of the two wouldst thou rightly esteem the stronger?
Go on, said I. No one can question but that he who has the natural capacity has more strength than he who has it not.
Now, the supreme good is set up as the end alike for both the bad and for the good, but the good seek it through natural action of the virtues, whereas the bad try to attain this same good through all manner of concupiscence, which is not the natural way of attaining good. Or dost thou think otherwise?
Nay, rather one further consequence is clear to me. For from my admissions it must needs follow that the good have power, and the bad are impotent.
Thou anticipatest rightly, and that, as physicians reckon, is a sign that nature is set working and is throwing off the disease. But since I see thee so ready at understanding, I will heap proof on proof. Look how manifest is the extremity of vicious men's weakness. They cannot even reach that goal to which the aim of nature leads and almost constrains them. What if they were left without this mighty, this well-nigh irresistible help of nature's guidance? Consider also how monumentous is the powerlessness which incapacitates the wicked. Not light nor trivial are the prizes which they contend for, but which they cannot win or hold. Nay, their failure concerns the very sum and crown of things. Poor wretches, they fail to compass even that for which they toil day and night. Herein also the strength of the good conspicuously appears. For just as thou wouldst judge him to be strongest walker, whose legs could carry him to a point beyond which no further advance was possible, so must thou needs account him strong in power, who so attains the end of his desires that nothing further to be desired lies beyond. Whence follows the obvious conclusion that they who are wicked are seen likewise to be wholly destitute of strength? For why do they forsake virtue and follow vice? Is it from ignorance of what is good? Well, what is more weak and feeble than the blindness of ignorance? Do they know what they ought to follow, but lust drives them aside out of the way? If it be so, they are still frail by reason of their incontinence, for they cannot fight against vice. Or do they knowingly and willfully forsake the good and turn aside to vice? Why, at this rate, they not only cease to have power, but cease to be at all. For they who forsake the common end of all things that are, they likewise also cease to be at all. Now, to some it may seem strange that we should assert that the bad, who form the greater part of mankind, do not exist, but the fact is so. I do not indeed deny that they who are bad, but that they are in an unqualified and absolute sense, I deny. Just as we call a corpse a dead man, but cannot call it simply man, so I would allow the vicious to be bad, but that they are, in an absolute sense, I cannot allow. That only is which maintains its place and keeps its nature. Whatever falls away from this forsakes the existence which is essential to its nature. But, thou wilt say, the bad have an ability, nor do I wish to deny it. Only, this ability of theirs comes not from strength, but from impotence. For their ability is to do evil, which would have no efficacy at all if they could have continued in the performance of good. So this ability of theirs proves them still more plainly to have no power. For if, as we concluded just now, evil is nothing, 'tis clear that the wicked can effect nothing, since they are only able to do evil.
'Tis evident.
and that thou mayst understand what is the precise force of this power, we determined, did we not, a while back, that nothing has more power than supreme good.
We did, said I.
But that same highest good cannot do evil?
Certainly not.
Is there anyone, then, who thinks that men are able to do all things?
None but a madman.
Yet they are able to do evil?
Aye, would they could not.
Since, then, he who can do only good is omnipotent, while they who can do evil also are not omnipotent, it is manifest that they who can do evil have less power. There is this also. We have shown that all power is to be reckoned among things desirable, and that all desirable things are referred to good as to a kind of consummation of their nature. But the ability to commit crime cannot be referred to the good. Therefore, it is not a thing to be desired. And yet all power is desirable. It is clear, then, that ability to do evil is not power. From all which considerations appeareth the power of the good, and the indubitable weakness of the bad, and it is clear that Plato's judgment was true. The wise alone are able to do what they would, while the wicked follow their own heart's lust, but cannot accomplish what they would. For they go on in their willfulness, fancying they will attain what they wish for in the paths of delight. But they are very far from its attainment, since shameful deeds lead not to happiness. When high enthroned the monarch sits, resplendent in the pride of purple robes, while flashing steel guards him on every side, when baleful terrors on his brow with frowning menace lower, and passion shakes his laboring breast, how dreadful seems his power! But if the vesture of his state from such a one thou tear, thou'lt see what load of secret bonds this lord of earth doth wear. Lust's poison rankles, or his mind rage sweeps in tempest rude. Sorrow his spirit vexes sore, and empty hopes delude. Then thou'lt confess, one hapless wretch, whom many lords oppress, does never what he would, but lives in thraldom's helplessness.
Before Lady Philosophy lays out her core argument, she first treats us to a few helpful reminders of things we covered in Book 3, Chapters 2 and 3. 1. The corrupt or evil seek the good by corrupt means. As we saw in previous chapters, they seek it by way of wealth, glory, pleasure, and various honors. Next, we saw in other chapters also that the corrupt never fully attain even the secondary goods they seek because of insecurities, incompetences, or incapacities of various kinds. Having reestablished this ground, she walks Boethius through the case in stereotypical Socratic fashion. For my part, I'm only going to formally summarize what her argument was in order to help you all see it more clearly. It comes in two parts. Lady Philosophy is nice enough to explicitly signpost this at the beginning of the dialogue, and they go a little something like this. Part 1. 1. Human action depends on a motivated will and the power to enact the will. 2. He who accomplishes his will has power, and he who fails to accomplish his will lacks power. 3. The will of man is directed toward happiness. 4. Happiness is identified with the absolute good. 5. So it is the absolute good that is willed in the name of happiness. 6. In the attainment of the good, man becomes good. 7. Therefore, the good men become good by attaining what they will. 8. Also, therefore, the good have power. Part 2. 1. The bad man seeks the good, just as the good man does. 2. If the bad man attains the good, he becomes good and is no longer bad. 3. Bad men never attain the good. 4. Therefore, bad men have no power. There are several subtle themes threaded into these arguments, and they are mainly derived from Plato's Gorgias. First is the idea that the rational will and animal desire are two different things. Second, that being in the thrall of one's untutored desires is to be powerless, or to put it in Humean terms, to be enslaved by the passions. To drive this home, here is the section from Plato's Gorgias in which much the same argument that Lady Philosophy has just given us is hashed out between Socrates and Polus. The following is an excerpt from Plato's Gorgias. It is a segment of the debate between Socrates and Polus on the question of desire or preference versus the will in pursuit of the good. We enter the discussion just after the point at which Socrates has defined rhetoric as a form of flattery. Polus naturally objects. And are the good rhetoricians meanly regarded in states under the idea that they are flatterers?
Is that a question or the beginning of a speech?
I am asking a question.
Then my answer is that they are not regarded at all.
How not regarded? Have they not very great power in states?
Not if you mean to say that power is a good to the possessor.
And that is what I do mean to say.
Then if so, I think they have the least power of all the citizens.
What? Are they not like tyrants? They kill and despoil and exile anyone whom they please.
I tell you, Polus, that rhetoricians and tyrants have the least possible power in states, as I was just now saying, for they do literally nothing which they will, but only what they think best.
And is not that great power?
Polus has already said the reverse.
Said the reverse? Nay, that is what I assert.
No, by the great... What do you call him? Not you, for you say that power is a good to him who has the power.
I do.
And would you maintain that if a fool does what he thinks best, this is a good, and would you call this great power?
I should not.
Then you must prove that the rhetorician is not a fool, and that rhetoric is an art and not a flattery. And so you will have refuted me. But if you leave me unrefuted, why, the rhetoricians who do what they think is best in a state, and the tyrants, will have nothing upon which to congratulate themselves, if, as you say, power be indeed a good, admitting at the same time that what is done without sense is an evil.
Yes, I admit that.
How then can the rhetoricians and the tyrants have great power in states unless Polus can refute Socrates and prove to him that they do as they will?
Oh, this fellow.
I say that they do not do as they will. Now refute me.
Why, have you not already said that they do as they think best?
And I say so still.
Then surely they do as they will.
I deny it.
But they do what they think best?
Aye.
That, Socrates, is a monstrous absurdity.
Do men appear to you to will that which they do, or to will that further end for the sake of which they do a thing? When they take medicine, for example, at the bidding of a physician, do they will the drinking of the medicine which is painful, or the health for the sake of which they drink it?
Clearly the health.
And when men go on a voyage or engage in business, they do not will that which they are doing at the time. For who would desire to take the risk of a voyage or the trouble of business? But they will to have the wealth for the sake of which they go on a voyage.
Certainly.
And is not this universally true? If a man does something for the sake of something else, he wills not that which he does, but that for the sake of which he does it.
Yes.
And are not all things either good or evil, or intermediate and indifferent?
To be sure, Socrates.
Wisdom and health and wealth and the like you would call goods, and their opposites evils?
I should.
And the things which are neither good nor evil, which partake sometimes of the nature of good and at other times of evil, or of neither, are such as sitting, walking, running, sailing, or again, wood, stones, and the like. These are the things which you call neither good nor evil?
Exactly so.
Are these indifferent things done for the sake of the good, or the good for the sake of the indifferent?
Clearly, the indifferent for the sake of the good.
When we walk for the sake of the good, under the idea that it is better to walk, and when we stand equally for the sake of the good?
Yes.
And when we kill a man, we kill him or exile him or despoil him of his goods because, as we think, it will conduce to our good?
Certainly.
Men who do any of these things do them for the sake of the good?
Yes.
And did we not admit that in doing something for the sake of something else, we do not will those things which we do, but that other thing for the sake of which we do them?
Most true.
Then we do not will simply to kill a man, or to exile him, or to despoil him of his goods, but we will to do that which conduces to our good, and if the act is not conducive to our good, we do not will it. For we will, as you say, that which is our good, but that which is neither good nor evil, or simply evil, we do not will.
You are right.
Hence, we may infer that if anyone, whether he be a tyrant or a rhetorician, kills another or exiles another or deprives him of his property, under the idea that the act is for his own interests, when really not for his own interests, he may be said to do what seems best to him.
Yes.
But does he do what he wills if he does what is evil?
Well, I suppose not.
Then if great power is a good, as you allow, will such a one have great power in a state?
He will not.
Then I was right in saying that a man may do what seems good to him in a state, and not have great power, and not do what he wills.
In addition to this, there is a third theme embedded in the chapter, namely that virtue necessitates mastery of the passions, and that mastery of the passions requires self-knowledge, which can only be obtained by contemplation of the good. Interestingly enough, this comes from Aristotle, at least in part. Lady Philosophy outlines almost verbatim from the Nicomachean Ethics three reasons why the wicked turn to vice. The first reason is failure to recognize the good. This is a reference to Plato's theory of knowledge as virtue. Ignorance is equivalent to corruption on Plato's account, because no man who honestly knew what the good was would pursue its opposite. But Aristotle argued that mere knowledge of the good by itself does not have the power to lead a man around like a slave, something Hume would have agreed with. The second reason is Aristotle's theory of incontinence. The virtuous man is the man who is habituated to acting always for the good, in the same way an excellent baseball player is able to make spectacular plays in the field, for example. The incontinent man is one who can see what is the good, but lacks the discipline to habituate himself to act consistently in ways that lead him to the good, in the same way a man who has gluttonous tendencies, but is not entirely a glutton, knows he should stop eating, but sometimes keeps eating anyway because the pleasure of the food overpowers him. The third reason is what Aristotle called obstinacy. This man knows what the good is, but actively avoids it in favor of cherished opinion, which is mainly driven by pleasure or pain. These men resemble virtuous men in mirror image, in the sense that they will pursue their opinion to the bitter end, in anticipation of a greater pleasure. This echoes both Socrates' exchange with Polus and with Callicles in the Gorgias. Lastly, I want to confront Boethius' claim that evil men don't exist. Here, Boethius seems to me to be putting his own incomplete opinion into the mouth of Lady Philosophy. She says she concedes that they exist, in a sense, but argues that those who do evil diminish their being, and the more they do it, the less being they have. To put it in her terms, they are, but not unequivocally, rather, only that they are evil. This is an odd claim, but it's a necessary consequence from the previous chapter. If you'll recall, we accepted that evil itself is nothing. Namely, since God is the highest good and can do all things, but he cannot do evil, evil must therefore not be a thing that can be done. By extension, then, to say that a man is evil is to say that a man is nothing. This seems to me to be a confusion on Boethius's part. He is mistaking the attribution of a property with the identification with the property. To make this more vivid, imagine I say that because Bob gets angry a lot, Bob is an angry man. But from this, it would be odd for me to say that Bob is anger, unless I were making one of those old Bob's picture in the dictionary jokes. Likewise, if I say that because Bob does evil things, Bob is an evil man, I am not saying that Bob is evil in the sense that he is identical to it, which would lead to the idea that Bob is nothing if we agree that evil is nothing. This might also be a failing of the translation, but given the way the dialogue plays out, it seems unlikely to me. If I'm right, then, the best that Boethius could argue here is that the man who does evil things is the man who does nothing, or perhaps is a man of no substance. And on an Aristotelian reading of substance, we could stretch this to mean that he is literally nothing. But now I'm just being silly. Finally, I would just like to encourage everyone to go read the Gorgias. This dialogue is an excellent encapsulation of Plato's views on natural and conventional justice, on what it means to know what the good is and to pursue it, and an essential key in understanding later thinkers like David Hume and Friedrich Nietzsche. Echoes of their voices can be heard all throughout this dialogue. Though it's not included in this podcast for the sake of brevity, I would especially direct you to have a look at the ranting monologue of Callicles, who offers the prototype to Nietzsche's will to power, and gives Socrates an opportunity to make a backhanded indictment of Jeremy Bentham for his naive utilitarianism. I am tempted to ask, do catamites play pushpin? And J.S. Mill for his incompetent attempt to escape the problem by categorizing pleasures, which forces him to appeal to a separate notion of the good as a standard of judgment, thus rendering utilitarianism itself impotent as a moral system. In any case, that's going to be it for this week's episode. Stay tuned for more.